The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Larkin, Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable Susan L. Siegel presiding.
Great, and we have one case on our oral calendar for today in the matter of the civil commitment of Colton Chase Camacho, case number, appeal number A220626. And we're sorry for the slight delay. We were actually having a few technical difficulties, actually I was trying to give tech advice, which my kids would laugh at heartily. But everything's working now. And if there are any problems during the hearing, as you know, you've both been on probably countless numbers of Zoom hearings already, just let us know. And we will let you know likewise if we're having trouble hearing you. There will be an audio recording of this posted online after our argument today. And so please just include your name when you're beginning your oral argument. And as you also know, appellant has 15 minutes with 5 minutes rebuttal, and respondent has 15 minutes in between. All right, with that, if you're ready, Mr. White, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Kenneth White. I'm an attorney from Mankato, Minnesota, and I represent the appellant Colton Camacho, and I note that the clock hasn't started. Is that part of the technical? There it goes.
Thank you for noticing.
I mean, I'd love to stand up here and talk for 25 minutes or 30 minutes, but I suspect that you have other things to do. So, Your Honors, as the court's aware, this is a case appealing a decision by the district court finding Mr. Camacho to meet the standards not only for a sexually dangerous person, but a sexual psychopathic personality, and as a result being committed to the facility in Moose Lake, Minnesota. There are three major topics that I'd like to address today, many of them related to what's in the respondent's brief and trying to respond to those. But also, I think, addressing a couple of the major issues that remain in this case. First of all, Your Honor, Your Honors, there's the discussion of whether or not Spicer is controlling. And I would suggest that nothing in this case has, or in this court's jurisprudence, has yet taken Spicer out of the toolkit, if you will, of tools that appellate judges can use in evaluating and should use in evaluating the civil commitment process. There are a number of cases, as cited by the county, that indicate that Spicer are rejecting Spicer-related arguments, but this court's never gotten to the point of saying Spicer is no longer good law. And in fact, under the most recent decision in State versus Chauvin, I'm not sure this court could go that far, since it has announced that it believes that its prior opinions are binding. And that will be important as we talk about the sexual SPP commitment. So given that Spicer controls, there are a couple of major points which I think Spicer demonstrates gives us a situation where the district court failed in its obligations in this case. First of all, almost all of the findings are simple recitations of testimony. This court has cautioned in Spicer and has cautioned in a number of cases since that is not a factual finding, that if a district court finds Mr. Smith testified the light was red, that's not a factual finding. The factual finding is the light was red. The basis for that would be Mr. Smith's testimony. And
Mr. White, I completely agree with you, the difference between a recitation of fact and a finding of fact. But here where you have so many witnesses testifying about, really specific facts, And you have these sort of recitation findings, or what I'll give you is, you know, as your characterization of them as recitation findings. But you have, in addition, credibility assessments, specific ones. Why aren't those in context sufficient to address the Spicer concern?
Well, Your Honor, I think there are two responses to that question. First of all, because they are merely recitations of fact, we don't have anything from the district court judge about which particular facts were found most persuasive. And Spicer tells us that that's part of the job of a district court making factual findings, as opposed to a jury, which just answers questions on a special verdict form. And so when you end up with mere recitations, you don't get the determination of which fact was actually found, and then which fact was most persuasive in the district judge's analysis of the particular legal standard that applied in the case.
But Mr. White, there are quite a few. They're just sprinkled kind of throughout. I'm looking at paragraph 203 now, which all seems to be true findings. The records of the assault are more credible and persuasive than Camacho's denial. According to Camacho's own testimony, he had sex with her, but not for money. Given the history, blah, 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 this is not credible. The records make it clear that BLG was terrified, et cetera, et cetera. This is not the behavior of an individual who's voluntarily engaging in sex. Camacho's general denial of the nature of the incident is not credible and persuasive. And why that those seem like true findings.
Your Honor, I do not disagree. There are true findings, as you put it, sprinkled throughout the district court's findings. But when you get down to the most critical kinds of factual findings for the issues in this case, you find that the district court judge relies much, much more on simple recitations. There was never any debate at the district court level that Mr. Camacho had engaged in harmful sexual conduct. That was never an issue that was raised in this case. And so all of those factual findings are basically undisputed here, even though the district court judge did not resolve some of the conflicts in the testimony of some of the young women, as noted in a footnote in my brief. So the critical question, though, here, I think, Your Honors, in terms of the Spicer analysis, is that the district court judge gives us very, very little about why she finds the particular opinions of various experts credible. There are references to applying the correct analysis and those kinds of statements, which do not tell this court anything about why the district court found a particular opinion more credible. And that becomes very, very important in this particular case, given the issues that exist with Dr. Alsdorf's testimony and the conflict between the experts, Dr. Ahlberg and Dr. Alsberg's testimony. The district court dismissed much of Dr. Ahlberg's testimony on the basis that he had one error in a date in his report. Yet the district court ignored the numerous errors by Dr. Alsdorf in his opinions that are discussed in our brief. And I'd just like to address a couple of those. For example, Dr. Alsdorf makes the alleged allegation that fails to distinguish in his report and relating what Dr. Bacchus had talked about between supervision and treatment programming. And that's a critical distinction, as this court knows. He makes no distinction between jail and prison. Again, a significant distinction. The county argues that, well, he must have been referring to the PSI out of Blue Earth County that relates to some issues that Mr. Camacho allegedly had in jail. That's not what Dr. Alsdorf says in his report, and there's no testimony from him that explains away that problem. The county alleges that when Dr. Alsdorf indicates that Mr. Camacho was non-compliant with a reference, or while in prison was non-compliant with the treatment recommendation. That's true, he was not, but he didn't have time to do the treatment, and that's undisputed in this record. And Dr. Alsdorf simply ignored
but
particular fact.
I appreciate that you can pick small parts out of various testimony, but it feels like you're asking us to reweigh the evidence, because I think as we've, you've also argued that the evidence was insufficient to establish that your client has met the criteria for either commitment is either an SDP or an SPP. And yes, you could look at it as a credibility question, I guess, which we don't second guess, but isn't it really more the issue before us whether there is evidence that supports the district court's findings?
Well, yes, Your Honor, but I think part of the problem and part of the analysis that this court has to go through in making that determination, and even under Kenny, you get to under the de novo review standard of whether the evidence in the record supports the ultimate legal conclusion, there's a decided lack of analysis by the district court that gives this court the opportunity to review what was done. And the Alsdorf versus Allberg debate is simply one example of that. There is nothing in the district court findings that addresses this issue that Dr. Kenning raised about the difference between what is normal sexual interest. I think her phrase was biological sexual interest in a certain age group versus that which is deviant. And the district court makes no specific discussion of how the district court reaches the conclusion that Mr. Camacho's activity here represents a deviance, nor does the district court address this convergence problem that Dr. Allberg and Dr. Kenning talk about, that what you're looking for is a convergence of all of the information. And Dr. Allberg says the static 99, even if you accept the +7 or +8, is outside of that norm and violates this rule of convergence that the experts seem to agree upon. Dr. Kenning never addresses that, and the district court never addresses it. And so you end up in a situation again where the evidence, the factual findings by the district court, don't get to the point of addressing those issues. I see I'm down to 4 minutes, and I do want to address this issue of Robb versus Preston, the two decisions of this court within a handful of days, and initially apologize to the court for not catching Preston. I will go to my grave wondering what happened. But I think the importance here of that distinction is largely twofold in terms of the SPP finding here. One is that Robb is the initial decision, and if this court is going to be consistent with its decision in Chauvin, should be the binding precedent that this court applies until the Supreme Court tells you and the practitioners of the world that there is something different. But second of all, I think this court got it right in Robb, and that is that this court needs to find a principled way to distinguish between sexual assault that causes the kind of bodily harm or mental harm necessary to meet the SPP standard and what I would call the natural or expected consequences of any kind of sexual assault.
Number of offenses weigh into that? I mean, I can see that for a single, criminal sexual conduct. Like, I can see that. If that, okay, serve your sentence. But if there's a number and they involve rapes, why can't we look at that? I mean, do they have to suffer more harm?
Your Honor,
victims? I mean, that's where I have a problem with that.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, these cases almost always arise out of multiple victims. Occasionally you get a single victim with multiple incidents, but they're almost always multiple victims. And so again, unless this court is prepared to head down the road of virtually everyone who is convicted of sexual assault or frequent or repeated sexual assault in Minnesota meeting the SPP standard, or at least that harm standard, there has to be a principled way to distinguish it. And I would suggest that the principled way to do that is to look at whether the harm that is suffered is something outside of the norm or the expected.
So what is the norm?
Well,
I mean, how do we, and I know that Rob, you know, a decision is there and it's out there. But I think our understanding of harm has evolved since then, particularly when you're involving children.
Well, Your Honor,
in 2001, juveniles could be charged with prostitution. That's not true anymore. It's not a crime any longer. I mean, it's a crime for the perpetrator. That hasn't changed.
There have certainly been changes and evolution in our understanding of the world. But here, Your Honor, even in this record, the experts talked about the kind of harm that one would expect from having young women, minors, engage in prostitution. And they talked about that kind of harm and said, that's the kind of harm that these young women have suffered. And so the record here gives you that evidence. And the record in all future cases, if you apply the standard
that I'm suggesting. So what would be the distinction then where a court could under the law say, yes, this is harm that reaches the SPP standard? What is that? I mean, do you have to land the person in the hospital for a month? I mean, I don't mean to sound so argumentative, but you're arguing kind of a very narrow point here.
Well, Your Honor, first off, the SPP statute is designed to be narrow. Mm-hmm. It's not designed to cast a broad net.
No, I agree. And these are serious issues, and I'm very mindful of that. So.
Second of all, and I see I've run out of time. Can I at least answer your question, Judge?
Yeah, yes, please do.
All right, thank you. I think you have to look for expert testimony that the parties would develop that would talk about what is the kind of, I don't want to use the word routine, but it's the only one that pops into my head right now, kind of harm that one would expect from this kind of sexual misconduct. In the Ince oral argument, I used the phrase, the ick factor, and that's the ick factor. All of these cases are icky, and all of the victims suffer harm. And so what you're looking for, I believe, under the SPP statute is some kind of harm that exceeds that norm, that normal, that expected by the experts. And again, the experts here talked about it. And so I think we have the answers in this particular case that the harm did not reach that level. And that if you have a situation, I suppose you could spin a hypothetical of a young woman who is engaged in prostitution and then commits suicide. That's not the kind of harm that one would expect from a young woman being forced into prostitution. And so that would be an example, Your Honor, of where you might find SPP kind of level harm. So I think I've answered your question, and I've more than used my time.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Mr. Cashman, when you're ready, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Siegel. Good morning, panel. And may it please the court, Mr. White. I'm going to work things kind of backwards here. In answer to the judge's, your Honor's question, in 1994, In re Rickmeyer, R-I-C-K-M-E-Y-E-R, came out of the Supreme Court. And the standard for, that's the only time the Supreme Court has directly addressed the issue of harmfulness under the SPP statute, the one that Mr. White cites to Rob. And the standard enunciated was that they're looking for conduct that, quote, creates a substantial likelihood of serious physical or emotional harm being inflicted on the victim. That is precisely the standard that's now contained in the sexually dangerous person statute. And that's part of the reason that was placed in there. That's where that comes from. That's why Rob was wrongly decided. And that's why when Preston came out, it directly criticized Rob and said, you know, what it, and also just as a practical matter, does the appellate court really want to get in the position of saying, well, your vaginal bleeding was worse than the other victim's vaginal bleeding, so therefore we're going to find SPP. It's not a comparative statute. That's a standard that's laid out in Rickmeyer, that's reestablished by Preston, and also almost every single subsequent case, including the one published decision that I could find in addition to Preston, which was In re Kindschy, K-I-N-D-S-C-H-Y. And so that standard is now in the SDP statute. And of note, in this case, Mr. White and Mr. Camacho have conceded that he meets that standard. So I submit this is really a red herring. Secondly, counsel spent some time talking about Spicer and the recitations of testimony and the findings. And what the court has to understand is this is the Minnesota Commitment and Treatment Act. And so unlike MI commitments or even MID commitments, individuals are coming in under STP and SPP petitions, have extremely long records, multiple assessments. And so the reason the district courts put in what counsel refers to as recitations of testimony or recitations of what are in the exhibits is because the findings of fact drive treatment when they get up to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. So if the district court gets the records and lays out all these recitations and tells the treatment team, this is what his history looks like, these are the assessments, these were the conclusions, this was the testimony at trial, it's to assist the treatment providers once they get up to the treatment program. And I would submit also that when you look at the Minnesota Chapter 253D and 253B, it actually requires the district court in SDP and SPP commitments to forward those voluminous records, which we mark as exhibits, up to the program so that they can be used in driving treatment and hopefully getting the individual out of the program as soon as possible.
Mr. Cash, I appreciate what you're saying about the extensive history and the fact that these orders tend to have a lot of fact findings that in fact detail such extensive history. But I think one of Mr. White's primary arguments here was that the district court did not provide us with sufficient findings as to how it weighed the credibility of the experts, including experts who didn't testify, whose reports were submitted and whose opinions weren't even mentioned in the order. How do you respond to that more nuanced argument about the insufficiency of the findings?
And that is another red herring, Your Honor. The court noted earlier, the findings are sprinkled throughout the record, and there are determinations as to why the court found Dr. Kenning and Dr. Alsdorf more credible than Dr. Alberg. And unlike what counsel suggested, that you know the issue of a course of harmful sexual conduct wasn't the issue, that actually was the main issue at the trial court because of the level of convictions. But when you look at the valuation of the court of between the examiners, one of the critical issues was this issue of the static 99R. Mr. White says, well, it wasn't discussed, but that's because Dr. Alberg more or less conceded that Dr. Kenning was correct. And I would note that even if you look at Dr. Alberg's report, and if you look at his score sheet for the static 99R, he doesn't score, I believe it's item number 3 or 4. specifically because he wasn't sure what the index offense was. And Mr. White submits in his brief that, well, Dr. Alberg was looking at this dicta by Judge Dougherty of the district court in one of the criminal cases. That's not what it was. It was he had the dates wrong. And I believe there was testimony at trial from all three examiners as to why that's a plus seven. Counsel now argues some of this issue of convergence, but actually convergence is a term that's used by psychologists, and it does indicate that he's highly likely to sexually reoffend, and he also has what I would call an utter lack of power to control sexual impulses. He had the static 99R, which is a plus seven, the static 2002R scored by Dr. Kenning, placed him in the well above average range, which is the highest range. The SARAG, even that Dr. Alsdorf scored him on, when compared against the general base rate statistics, is like he's five times the 11% base rate statistic that Dr. Albert was citing as the standard for Minnesota offenders, which it doesn't really apply, as explained in the findings. But so the issue of convergence is not an issue because the doctors basically agreed that he was in this well above average risk category. And the other thing the court should remember is that, so for example, when Dr. Alberg scored him on the SORAG and said he's in this medium range, but that's as compared to other offenders. The standard enunciated in statute and with subsequent case of high likelihood of sexual reoffend is a comparison to the general population. And so if he's a medium risk compared to somebody who's already offended, that's pretty high risk. And the court did go into why it made numerous findings as to why Drs. Kenning and Dr. Alsdorf were more credible. And I also point out the court made specific findings too as to Mr. Camacho's behavior, both in the criminal cases and in the commitment cases. First of all, in the commitment cases, he took the Fifth Amendment when being asked about victim BMW. Why? Because she was 15 years old at the time, and it's a crim sex three that he really engaged in with her by, and he took a plea. He was manipulative, as the court finds, in that he was stalking this investigator, J.H., who testified about the effect it had on both him and his family. He also stalked and harassed and made the sexual proposition to one of the victims from his offenses, AJR, and her mother. So there are all kinds of findings like that. And as far as the issues of finding which facts are most important, the court does go into that. It makes specific findings. And what this court has to remember too as well, which is that, for example, when you're talking about the case law factors under Blodgett or the SPP things, a lot of those also apply to high likelihood. Now, you can go back and make a finding each time that, oh, and this also applies to the issues of high likelihood, or some of the findings that found that there was a specific victim in what happened, that also applies to issues of high likelihood or mental disorder. But then we would have 200-page findings rather than 100-page findings. And I think the court, what counsel is trying to argue is that, well, you've got to, you have to read all these sentences or paragraphs in disjunctive, and it's all one order. And when you read it, the court thoroughly explains what it found important and why he met each and every element.
Mr. Cashman, what's the strongest evidence you can point to that would support the finding that Mr. Camacho has an utter lack of ability to control his sexual urges. Is it simply the expert testimony, or is there other evidence that supports it?
It's the expert testimony and the fact that, two things. Number one, he, when discovered, and this he's pending on these criminal charges, he goes back after AJR and her mother. And secondly, his behavior, this is somebody who, his behavior shows that he does have these antisocial personality traits or features. And it also shows that he has this driving sexual behavior, which brings me to the point of Mr. White's argument about that none of the experts explain, you know, if adult men are sexually, it's normal for adult men to be sexually attracted to what I would call adolescent girls. They didn't explain why it's deviant. All three of the examiners talked about that. It's deviant because he acted on it. He went out and sought out juvenile girls to have sex with and raped some of them. And not only that, when he was discovered, he's so antisocial that he is actually going after the investigator who's investigating many of these crimes. And so what makes it deviant is the fact he acted on it. All three examiners talk about it in the report or in the testimony. And again, it's not in the disjunctive. You've got to read the whole report and understand what they're talking about. Also, contrary to counsel's statement at the beginning, well, Dr. Ahlberg only had one error in his report. He actually had multiple errors because Mr. Camacho had six convictions for prostitution, seven convictions for prostitution when you include BMW. And Ms. Dr. Ahlberg at times in his report talks about four or five. He doesn't include the full amount. And that becomes important because as the court found, he did not understand Mr. Camacho's record. And as far as Dr. Alsdorf's errors that counsel points to in his report, almost all of them can be explained because these are psychologists who testify. So when they talk about prisons or jails, they talk about supervision or probation, they don't know the difference. And so when they talk about that, that's what they're talking about.
I ask a question though? So on that, the utterly unable to control, I mean, there was, as it was characterized and found by the district court and the expert, it was really grooming behavior. I mean, showing quite a bit of, time in getting to know these vulnerable kids, et cetera. So isn't that contrary? I mean, how do you deal with that? And that's an issue that Mr. White raised in his briefing.
The grooming behavior, I believe it's Perkle there's case law that says that even grooming behavior is indicative of an under lack of part of control. There's not a requirement that all of a sudden somebody just spring out of the bushes and sexually assault somebody. So there was both grooming behavior and violent behavior. So for example, with LMM, the last time he had been grooming her and then he started paying her money. And then the last offense that happened, which was really a crim sec, if the conduct, you look at the conduct, not the conviction, but the conduct was, you know, a violent rape in his driveway and out in his garage. And so the grooming behavior indicates our lack of part of control of sexual impulses. And going back, I'm out of time. Can I just finish my sentence?
Yes, please.
So the grooming behavior, when you're paying somebody money and then they're going along with it, they're a vulnerable teen, and then they say no, and then it turns violent. That shows an utter lack of part of control, his sexual impulses under the various cases that are out there, because now he's being denied what he wants for his deviant sexual behavior and he acts on it. Thank you.
Any questions from the panel for Mr. Cashman? No? All right, Mr. White.
I muted myself. Thank you, Your Honor. Let me try to focus on very quickly on four major issues. First, in relation to this issue of harm under the SPP statute, counsel says you should look to Rickmeyer. Well, the problem with Rickmeyer is Rickmeyer says that you need to have a substantial likelihood of harm. Doesn't describe the nature of the harm. Whether that is what I've referred to as routine or expected harm or something that is beyond that. And so I don't think Rittmeyer gets you to the answer. And so we end up with this conflict between Rob and Preston that somebody's going to have to ultimately resolve.
Why doesn't the fact that Mr. Camacho has guns and uses them and has the people use them and has handcuffs, I mean, why doesn't that evidence cross the threshold, if you will, to make a substantial likelihood of harm a reasonable finding by the district court?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think the problem is that the district court doesn't connect the dots and that we're dealing with harm related to the sexual offense. And if there had been expert testimony that it was a result of the use of a gun that increased the level of harm, again, beyond what would have been expected from a gun being used, then I think that would play a role. But we don't have any of those kinds of factual findings by the district court here. Second of all, under the SPP statute, the court asked about the utter lack of control. I think that's a significant issue that obviously is addressed at some length in the briefs. But the issue here with the utter lack of control, Your Honor, is that, again, the district court does not address in how the district court is reaching the conclusion that he has the utter lack of control. And the experts don't connect the dots either. What is it about his particular behavior that demonstrates this utter lack of control? And we have the issues of grooming behavior, which obviously is a thoughtful process and does not demonstrate an utter lack of control. We have Mr. Camacho providing rides to young women and attending teenage parties. And not acting out when he's attending those, but at least one person then ends up in the kind of grooming category. So I think if you look at this particular case, the evidence here is that at most Mr. Camacho meets the SDP statute and doesn't get to the level of SPP, given that the lack of evidence of an utter lack of control. So,
Mr. White, how do you respond, or can we? Mr. Cashman suggests that we can look at an utter inability to control. That yeah, he engaged in grooming activity, but when they said no, that he went ahead and engaged in rape. I mean, so can we look at that?
Your Honor, I think that is evidence that a court could look at, but then the district court has the job to connect those dots and to say Mr. Camacho engaged in grooming behavior, and when he wasn't successful that way, then he took greater action, and that demonstrates the utter lack of control. There's a description of him having antisocial behavior. Those are features that the judges or that the experts found, but certainly not to the level of having an antisocial personality issue that they could diagnose under the DSMs. Third point I wanted to make, Your Honor, counsel argued at length that the findings by the district court are treatment driven or are designed to assist in driving the treatment. That may be true, but it's not the way we decide cases. We decide cases by district court judges making factual findings and then reaching a legal conclusion of that, and this court then evaluating whether the evidence supports those factual findings, and assuming so, whether that evidence, that body of evidence, rises to the level to meet the standards required under the statutes, and whether treatment providers are ultimately driven by the district court findings is not something that this court needs to concern itself with. And lastly, there's this issue about Dr. Ahlberg. I would simply refer the court to page 550 of the transcript where Dr. Ahlberg talks about decision by the district court judge, Judge Dougherty, in the criminal case and how that's not sex related. And that's one of the reasons that he discounted that particular incident for the static 99 evaluation. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both. Any other questions from the panel? No. All right. Well, thank you both for your oral arguments and your briefing. Very thorough on both counts. This case is now submitted, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time period. So thank you both very much.
Thank you, Honor. Thank you, Mr. White.
Thank you, you too.